So our next speaker is Debbie Jaffe-Ellis, who would talk about, somebody's trying to call me via Skype now, of course. Can you stop it for a second? So the title of the talk is Albert Ellis, A Model of Resiliency, Compassion, and Stoicism in Action. We will start with a short video. No? We will end with a short video. And right now, we have, in fact, Debbie. Come on in.
Hi, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here. Tell me, wave if you can't hear me. In this sanctuary of sanity, when I think about what's going on in the world outside, my late great husband, Albert Ellis, used to say when talking about the human tendency to unnecessarily create concern and worries and misery, he would say, if the Martians came to Earth, they would die laughing. That presumes, of course, they have a sense of humor. And I think if they came to Earth now, if they had tear ducts, they'd be crying tears with their laughter, or maybe sadness and empathy, or both. But in any case, it's great to be here. And I want to thank Messina and Amy and Greg and for making all this possible, and to thank all of you. My late great husband may have been the most effective ambassador for Stoic philosophy of the 20th and 21st centuries. I, luckily and sadly, was with him only for the final 15 years of his life. Luckily, because I was, sadly, not long enough. And in all the talks he and we presented, whenever he would talk about his influences, he'd talk about the Stoics and others. And in every one of his 85 published books and many chapters in other books and over 2,000 articles, if he talks about his influences, Stoic philosophy is in there. So hooray for Albert Ellis in terms of incorporating into his brilliant, holistic, compassionate, no bullshit, am I allowed to say that, approach, therapeutic approach of rational emotive behavior therapy, the profoundly important Stoic philosophy. And as Donna this morning referred to him, you know, REBT was the pioneering cognitive approach that heralded in the cognitive revolution. Aaron Beck, father of CBT, acknowledges my husband for his influence and his help in his formulating his work. And then Marty Seligman and positive psychology also, and so many other approaches that have been influenced by Al, who was influenced by the Stoics. And so it's wonderful to have this opportunity to acknowledge that. But what I feel is profoundly important to share with you, and it's my joy to be able to do so today, is that my husband was not only a massively effective teacher of elements of Stoic philosophy and his approach of REBT, but he was a model of a human who practiced it in adverse situations. And throughout my husband's life, from infancy onwards, he had some seriously challenging and difficult circumstances to cope with, which he did admirably and elegantly. Now, there's no doubt he was born a genius. That's just a biological fact. But also, he was an avid reader, and he read any book that he could get his hands on. Of course, he loved reading the Stoic philosophers and Eastern philosophers and anything else he could get his hands on. But in addition to his innate creativity that contributed to his creating his REBT approach, and in addition to what he learned from what he read, It was the way he coped with his own emotional pain and then translated it into language that both academics and the general members of the general public could understand, assimilate, and apply if they chose to do so. That marks one of his greatest contributions, frankly, to humanity. So I only have a very few minutes because I want half of my allotted time to give you the pleasure of seeing video, that's not it, of Al, and I'll say more about that just before we show it. But what I want to share with you are just a few of the painful situations that he experienced throughout his life and the ways he coped with them. You'll recognize the Stoic aspects and the way they became a part of his approach that had helped and still helps millions of people suffer less emotional misery and experience more joy in life, this one life we have. So when he was a young child, he suffered from many debilitating illnesses, including nephritis and others, and he was often hospitalized for long periods of time from the age of 3 and a half onwards. And his busy parents rarely would visit him. And understandably, he felt very, very sad. And at that young age, 3 and a half, 4, he made the decision. By the way, I'm not making this up. I heard him share this with me directly and with thousands of people he would teach. He made the decision that he didn't want to feel so sad. And so he actively looked for ways to distract his mind so that he wouldn't feel as sad about something that in reality was sad. His parents weren't visiting him. So he borrowed books from the hospital library there. He talked to other children on his ward and to their visitors. He made up games. He imagined what he would do when he grew up, and in that way felt less sad. So that was to become the part of REBT known as cognitive distraction, also seen in CBT. Then when he was a teenager, hormones burning and buzzing or whatever hormones do, and he fell in love with 101 out of 100 women, girls, but he was too shy to ask them out on dates, terrified. And having read the work of the behaviorist Watson, he told himself that if little kiddies can get over their phobias, so can I. And he gave himself the homework of talking to 100 women over the month of August in the Bronx Botanical Gardens near where he lived, with the conscious intention of, I am going to do what I now find uncomfortable in order that I get comfortable with it, to prove to myself that I probably won't die if I talk to a female and to get over this fear and phobia. And so he did that, spoke to 100 women, made one date, and she didn't show up, but he got over his fear. And that is a part now of the REBT approach, in vivo desensitization. Well, fast forward, and he's 24 and madly in love with a young, and I mean young woman, 18, called Carol, who he's married to for 18 hours. Long story short, her parents found out, they married in secret and they annulled the marriage. Anyway, he was madly in love with her. And she was on again, off again, and one night after they had had an extremely romantic, intimate time, she walked him to the door and said, Al, I think we need to break up. I'm really young and I'm not sure about this. And so he said that it was one of the few times in his life he shed tears. And he went for a walk around the Bronx Botanical Gardens near, those gardens are sanctified by my husband, I'm sure, to ponder this, the pain. It's not that he was suicidal, but he felt life had no meaning for him anymore without Carol in his life. And he had an epiphany. He realized that his pain, his depression, his despondency was not because she rejected him, but because of what he was telling himself about the fact that she rejected him. Number one, she shouldn't reject me. After last week, she says she loves me. Overgeneralizations such as I can never be happy without her. I must have her in my life. He realized that even if he could never be as happy again in his life without a doll like Carol, he probably still could find some meaning, if not happiness. He probably could meet other women. By the way, hello, and hundreds in between. Anyway, he realized that by thinking in absolutistic ways and by demanding things should be fair and she should do what he does, he was creating his own misery. And that is such a core part of REBT and other cognitive approaches. That when we think in demanding, absolutistic ways, we create unhealthy negative emotions. Well, quickly fast forwarding to the work that he did. I'm leaving out so many parts, but doing the best I can. And so he formulated REBT. He thought Freudian psychoanalysis was inefficient. And when he first presented it to his colleagues and peers, the majority of whom were into psychoanalysis, he was criticized, called stupid, simplistic, and worse. And he decided, I will not let them stop me. He made a determined choice to keep pursuing what he believed and had not just believed, had experienced, was effective, and could help other people. And as many of us probably now know, the cognitive approach is the most widely used approach in psychotherapy. Well, fast forwarding to the final chapter of his life, his final years, we were together. That was the greatest part, certainly for me, and he said for him. And out of the blue, frankly, in our work environment, a devastating thing happened. For reasons I can't and won't go into right now because of time, he was stopped from working in his own institute. He was treated in ways by people, some of whom he treated like his own children. He was treated in ways he considered brutal. We were no longer allowed to teach in his institute. That didn't stop us. We rented a room in the building next door, and we continued, and we were fighting for justice. And the fatigue of that, due to that, Al succumbed to pneumonia. He was already 90. Doctors prepared me, he's going to die any minute now. He survived another 15 months, albeit no more food or water by mouth, tubes, and still in hospital and rehab, groups would come in and he would share his approach with as many people as he can. In the autobiography, you'll see a photo of him in the trauma room of the New York Presbyterian Columbia, such a long name, hospital, because this group had arranged to see him in rehab, but there was an emergency, but he got better. But I have two more minutes. Good, that's fine. So, and he spoke to them in the trauma room, reminding them that even if things are dire, if you're still alive and can think, there's hope. In his final weeks, he knew he was not going to get well. He knew he would not regain power in the institute that he had founded. He accepted reality. Did the master practice what he preached? Yes. Because despite and including those realizations, he and we focused. We chose, it's a choice, to focus on what still was good. And at that time, the only good thing was the love we had. And we focused on that and felt grateful, grateful, grateful. Now, you're going to see a video, 15 minutes, and it's hodgepodgey. Some guys who, they were guys, so it's not being sexist. Not gals, guys. I said they would make a documentary, haven't made it yet, hope they will soon, but they gave me these bits and pieces. A few are from early days, but most of them were taken at his final conference, the Evolution of Psychotherapy conference at the end of 2005. And unbeknown to, I think, everyone there but me, he was in agonizing pain. This was after 15 months of fighting for justice, not being allowed to teach in his own institute. His health was even then failing. And yet you will see him, you'll know what I'm talking about, that where he's talking and answering questions at the conference. He was in agonizing back pain, and yet you'll see him focusing on talking, on answering questions. You'll see, if you're able, passion in his eyes, sometimes love in his eyes. A true model of, despite being in agonizing pain, including that, despite that, he was able to be in the moment and also experience joy as he contributed to other humans. He was an amazing human, and I think we all benefit directly and indirectly because he walked on this planet. So enjoy Albert Ellis. Thank you.
We are nearing the end of our therapeutic journey. Now for Dr. Albert Ellis.
Ask yourself, what do I really want to do with this man to help enjoy him and have him help enjoy me, because that's the basic function of life, enjoyment, which we tend to lose. And you force yourself to take the risk of...
In the old days, when I first began therapy, I practiced what could be called the sort of eclectic kind of sex therapy and marriage and family therapy, though that didn't almost exist at that time. But I was one of the pioneers in the field, and eclectic psychotherapy. I used to be scared witless of approaching females. What's so bad about encountering females? What are they going to do? Kill me, or in the Freudian sense, castrate me? So I decided that for the next month, every time I saw a woman sitting on the bench alone, I would go up and start a conversation. My goal was to approach at least 100 of them. Whatever happened, happened. If I die, I die. I was going to do this kind of thing. Skinner was wrong because I got zero reinforcement. I made a date with only one out of the 100, and she never showed up for the date. So you can see that I got no reinforcement, but amazingly, I got completely over my fear of encountering women. So the homework assignment I'm going to give all of you is, you go out in public and do something that you consider shameful, embarrassing, humiliating, and something you normally would not do in public.
Advice, 5 cents. Advice, 5 cents. Want some advice for 5 cents?
Give you advice. I broke all records at the age of 6 or 7 for taking books out of the library and returning them the next day read. At the age of something like 12 in junior high school, they nicknamed me Encyclopedia. He knows everything because I read everything in sight. I began to read all kinds of people when I was 12, fiction and nonfiction, and Freud was one of the nonfiction, so I read a great deal of his. My opinion of Freud at that point was that he was very much of a genius, but he went all around the mulberry bush and found reasons why people were disturbed, which weren't really true. He invented them. I read H.G. Wells and Bertrand Russell and a lot of liberal novelists who had philosophy in So I was interested in their stories, but I was also interested in their attitude toward life and how they helped themselves get through difficulties.
I wasn't good enough for anybody else.
Suppose you're not good enough for her. She likes you taller or shorter or more money. How does that prove that you're a no good person?
At that point in my life, I was measuring myself based on my relationship. I invested so much into my relationship that it became my life.
Yeah, you made your relationship the whole of your life. It's only a part of your life. Never the whole, unless you think it is. Yeah. If I did what you did, I wouldn't finish any books.
Right. That's a good point, yes.
But I write them imperfectly.
Yes.
And they get by, and they still help people, even though they're imperfect.
So I, from what you say, I draw the conclusion that the one way to overcome this need for certainty is to just do things in a certain time limit and then just let it go and do the next thing.
Let go.
Who wants to volunteer to be cured?
Preferably with a relationship problem.
Oh, preferably with a relationship problem, I think. Here you have one. Okay. Perhaps if you line up down there, this gentleman will be
those who want to volunteer. How many volunteers?
Too many.
How many volunteers for now?
One at a time.
I know.
So the activating event for adversity is asthma. And it's seen.
Eczema. But I have that too.
Oh, so yeah.
Well, either one is fine.
Well, stick to the eczema.
Okay.
Where is it written that you must not have eczema?
In Cosmo, in Vogue.
What?
In all the fashion magazines.
Well, who gives a shit for the fashion magazine? I don't.
That's true.
Right. Where else is it written, I must not have eczema? Where?
With my family.
So they're as crazy as you are.
Pretty much.
Okay, Marion, what problem do you want to bring up?
Well, this is kind of an embarrassing problem because it's a sex problem. Can you hear me?
Yeah, if you keep it up.
Okay. I like that. Is there any kind of conversation you can recommend when you want to bring the topic up?
Yeah. You say, I'd like to talk about sex.
I have a question regarding the thinking of something, you know, bad and inconvenient versus horrible and awful. But when it comes to something like the Holocaust or any kind of ethnic cleansing, it's hard for me to not just think that's horrible and awful and really be brought down by that. So can you comment on how you would use REBT to deal with a situation as bad as ethnic cleansing, you know, some very horrible, well, seemingly horrible situation?
To deal with the Holocaust?
Yeah, it's very hard for this woman to see things like the Holocaust as not being horrible and awful. How does REBT show that they're not or say that they're not?
Well, REBT, I think, is the only cognitive behavior therapy and the only one of all different 200 types of therapy which says that many things are bad. You don't get what you want, and you do get what you don't want. That's bad. And a few things are very bad. But nothing is awful, horrible, and terrible. Because one, even though there's a hurricane and 50,000 people are killed, there could be two hurricanes and kill 100,000. So things always could be worse. And no matter how bad things are, and they sometimes are exceptionally bad, like the Holocaust in Israel or other places, in European countries, there could be two or three Holocausts, and although about 5 million or 10 million people are killed, it could be more than that. So some things are bad, a few things are exceptionally bad, and kill or harm or control the freedom of millions of people, but it's still not awful. And what's more, no matter how bad it is, you can stand it, you can take it, and not be happy about it. That would be abnormal. But in spite of it, you can lead a happy life. Debbie's family, for example, her mother and father went through the Holocaust, but they got by and still led a happy life, and many other people have. So it's never hopeless, it's never totally bad, it's just exceptionally bad that you are an individual who can cope, and sometimes happily cope, with exceptionally bad things. So again, nothing is horrible, awful, and terrible, and no matter how bad it is, unless they actually kill you, you can take it and still lead pleasurable and happy existence.
Dr. Ellis, I'm a practicing psychotherapist and have appreciated your many contributions through the year. We've all been enriched by it. I've appreciated your optimism and what you've described today. One area that has always puzzled me has been your ideas about religion, spirituality. I wonder if you can comment on your thoughts about religion and spirituality today and the role that it has in psychotherapy.
Well, people are entitled to be as religious as they want to be and as spiritual as they want to be. But I have shown in the Journal of Individual Psychology, the Adlerian Journal, and in other places here, that if you're rationally spiritual, then you decide to be in favor of and to help other people and to make the world better. And if you're irrationally spiritual and religious, then you can be bigoted and knock down and kill other people. So spirituality and religion. Very good as long as they have quite rational elements in them.
Yes. First, I would like to ask where you found such a lovely lady as Debbie, and are there any more? And secondly, I would like to say that my fondest wish is that at 92, I will have your wit, your insight, and your therapeutic skill. If that's feeble, God help us all.
Thank you. I didn't find Debbie, she found me. She's been devoted in teaching RABT and being a therapist in Australia for over 10 years. And she decided that she liked to keep visiting the United States and me. So finally we fell in love, and it's the happiest moment in my whole life, my whole life.
Dr. Ellis, 20 years ago, I sat on your stage as a volunteer, and you helped me a great deal in less than 5 minutes. I am a licensed psychologist, and I have a chronic nightmare that there's one more paper I have to write. And I wake up with a sweat every night. I ask you, can you address us clinicians who are ready to write, who are clinically treated? What do you suggest we write now?
And what?
What should we write to remove the nightmare?
What would you suggest clinicians write? This practitioner, this woman has a nightmare that there's one more paper for her to write.
There's many more papers. If you don't have to do them perfectly well and don't have to get universal acclaim for them, then as I do at the age of 92, I've written in the last few years 5 new books, and 2 I'm working on at present time. So there's many, many things you can do if you don't think you have to do them marvelously and perfectly well.
I thank you.
Dr. Ellis, I appreciate that your career is just still a work in progress, but at this early point in your career, how would you characterize your legacy so far?
How would I what?
The gentleman realizes your life is still a work in progress, but at this early point in your career, how would you describe your legacy so far?
My legacy, I hope, is myself and the way I refuse to upset myself when bad things happen. And all the principles of RABT, you largely upset yourself. You can change it. You have choices. And you can choose. USA, unconditional self-acceptance. UOA, unconditional other acceptance. And ULA, unconditional life acceptance. So go work your ass off and choose it.